back to Home Alone. Just want to fixate on that for a moment. Home Alone and Nosferatu are kind of the same movie because in the same way, think about it. No, I'm dead serious. The camera pulls back. We reveal that this girl who is praying desperately and emerging from the darkness for any being of any celestial sphere, just because she's so lonely and distraught as she's wearing, speaking of the Rider-Waite-Hare, her big moon hat, very reminiscent of the High Priestess card. So she uses these powers to reach out, just like Kevin McAllister. And we're back.
Hey guys.
Woo!
Happy 2025!
Woo! 2025! Yeah, this is our first podcast of the new year, and I think this will be the 12th episode released, but it is lucky number 13 in its episode code, because we have recorded 13 episodes. 13, which in, of course, the Rider-Waite Tarot and every other tarot, is death, and boy, is this an appropriate movie. The most appropriate Christmas movie we could possibly have.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No movie could speak more to the Christmas spirit than Nosferatu, released this Christmas day.
Yeah. And we should just talk about this right up top, which is a weird series of synchronicities led to this being the third in a trilogy that we didn't even know we were recording, which is a trilogy of Chris Columbus. Yes, a trilogy of Chris Columbus movies. In that we did just kind of randomly two episodes ago was about a Christmas movie party at the Alamo Drafthouse for Gremlins, which we saw. It was really awesome, which was, of course, Chris Columbus's breakout movie as a screenwriter that made his career. Then we went to the amazing Paramount screening of Home Alone, again, just what happened to be happening in Austin. Saw it with 1,000 kids. We talked about it on an episode that will actually be being released today, the day we're recording this. And, and that was an amazing experience. For the second week in a row, we were talking about Chris Columbus, and we pretty much thought that was it. Literally, as of the time we recorded this episode last week, I was simultaneously aware that we were probably going to see Nosferatu because we wanted to see it, and we probably were going to talk about it on the next episode. And then I was rather blindsided when seeing a random clip on Twitter or something like that of Robert Eggers talking about how thankful he was for his mentor, Chris Columbus, who was on set every day of Nosferatu. So my brain rather reeled from that, and I was like, what? It's like I felt like my brain had stitched that in time and that I was actually still asleep. And then turns out, no. In fact, not only did Chris Columbus produce Nosferatu and was on set of Nosferatu every day, but in fact has been mentoring Robert Eggers since the inception of his career, and apparently was a producer on The Witch. Not to say, I assumed, oh, he must have gotten involved in its distribution after it was a hit or something. No, apparently found him in that project organically through his company, Maiden Voyage. Get it? His name's Chris Columbus, Maiden Voyage. Taylor gets it.
It's a joke.
But he ended up blah, 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 making all of these movies. He didn't produce The Northman, I guess, but they apparently have been working together on Nosferatu for a little while. So here we are.
I think in that one extra, he said like over 10 years that he'd been working on the
story,
at least.
Yeah, I think around the time of The Witch, yeah, they said whatever it was, they were trying to make Nosferatu, and I guess it in multiple incarnations fell apart over the years. And like a lot of good projects often, that stand out in directors' careers, be it like Back to the Future or Inception, they often are things that filmmakers try to make, can't get made, and therefore they get like 7 to 10 years to gestate and get better.
Get Out is a great example of
that's
that.
A good point.
Out was Jordan Peele's breakout, and it took him multiple years, and it was spooky too.
Yeah, I think in the original draft of Back to the Future that they were trying to get made, there was no DeLorean, and it was a phone booth that was the time machine.
Doctor Who.
And very, very Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh, fair, touche.
Which is, I mean, Doctor Who, what is that? I don't know.
That's that British stuff.
Something strange is afoot at the Circle K. anyway, so in this weird series of triptych synchronicity, we now do our final episode in our Chris Columbus trilogy, Nosferatu, which is a film of which there are many contrasts that could be enumerated between it and Home Alone and Gremlins. Cliff, what's one thing that's different about Home Alone and Nosferatu? Let's see if we can split this hair. Let's see if we can parse it.
Well, first of all, I think let's lean a little bit into the Christmas theme for some fun here, because it does... Christmas, we must remember that... the big JC was probably not born on a December 25th. But the December 25th is very close to the darkest time of the year. Mm-hmm. The days are the shortest. It is cold. Mm-hmm. It feels like there's no hope in the world for anything. And it's in this season that we have all the beautiful electric Christmas lights that are on Kevin McAllister's house, let's say, in Home Alone, that keep the dark, scary things at bay. Cliff. For this movie, there are no Christmas lights.
It's
as dark as it gets. Mm-hmm. You see all the darkness of the end of the year, given full rain.
Quite a bit of darkness.
Mm-hmm, quite a bit of darkness. This might be the dark, physically one of the darkest movies I've ever seen. Yeah. Most of the screen, most of the time, is black.
Yes.
And when you can see something, you can just barely register.
Yeah. You know, I can say that is something that is tricky to play with. A lot of that kind of craftsmanship for shooting black cinematography that is just black on black on black is really difficult, because things can, and again, it's why it's really good to see this movie in a theater, because if you're at home with like light bleeding in from the kitchen light that's on, or like, you know, some blinds or some other things, you know, that's enough to wipe out certain images in this movie. Like, there's even in the theater, you can see when, and we'll get to all this in a minute, but in the fantastic sequence where Nosferatu is seen for the first time, you know, when the Jonathan Harker character, I'm sure he has a name in the movie, but we'll call him that.
Something more German-like.
Is meeting Orlok for the first time. There are moments where he is almost introduced, Orlok is introduced by our eyes getting used to the black, where he is entirely this silhouette you can't even make sense of, because it's shapes of fur and different, and his weird hat he's wearing. And then he's sitting at a table with a fire roaring behind him. Subtle. And then by the time we return to him, they've slightly increased, you know, our ability to make out his face, and the black is being penetrated by like half a stop. It goes from total black to like half a stop, and you can just make out the edges of his nose and mustache. And it's like being able to play in that level and having the confidence to do it, especially these days when you know, when some filmmakers treat it as a foregone conclusion that their film will not be seen in a movie theater where that stuff is perceptible, I think is really cool. And it was very, very, very dark. But by the way, Cliff, back to Home Alone. Just want to fixate on that for a moment. Home Alone and Nosferatu are kind of the same movie, because in the same way, think about it. No, I'm dead serious. The opening of, and this brings us beautifully to the opening of Nosferatu, is that at the opening of Nosferatu, what happens? And this is, we don't know 100% what's going on until Lily Rose Depp explains it at a later point. She was in a state of desperation. We begin on total blackness. Her face emerges from this black void. The camera pulls back, we reveal that this girl who is praying desperately and emerging from the darkness is praying in her own bedroom, in her bed, for any being of any celestial sphere, because she's so lonely and distraught. I honestly can't remember why she said she was lonely and distraught later on, but she reaches out for any being with her psychic powers that she has had since she was a kid, because in a previous age, she would have been a great priestess of Isis, which is another really cool line, as she's wearing, speaking of the Rider-Waite-Terre, her big moon hat, very reminiscent of the High Priestess card. So she uses these powers to reach out, but what does she get back? Not what she was expecting. The creature that reaps, she then begins to convulse and all these other things, and it turns out that the being that reaches back across eons of time to find this priestess of Isis and feast upon her soul that's been roused from its eternal slumber by her power is Nosferatu. Just like Kevin McAllister. Think about it. Kevin McAllister, his whole family makes him feel what? Isolated and alone. What do? They send Kevin McAllister back up to the attic to sleep with Fuller, played by the other Culkin who's on Succession, but who cares because I don't watch that show. But anyway, he goes up there. What does he then do? He's now, just like Lily Rose Depp, been banished to an upper room in this giant, stately Victorian home. Mm-hmm. And so he also reaches out for a spirit of any celestial sphere to make his family disappear, which we then see manifested in all of those beautiful shots of wind that we've talked too much about already, that blow the branches, blow the trees, and then knock down all the shit. And then we get all the encoded angel imagery later on, but is essentially like a be careful what you wish for story, a spirit you know, that you're hoping, that you maybe secretly are hoping wasn't listening to your prayer, was listening to your prayer, and it's actually coming to deliver you, you know, a difficult ordeal, but that ultimately is what was needed to, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And so in that way, the opening of Home Alone, think about it, Nosferatu, same movie. Cliff, go ahead. Sorry.
Basically the same movie. Yep. Now, praying for what essentially is an ordeal, a gauntlet for the protagonist to have to go through. Mm-hmm. And like Kevin McAllister, Lily Rose Depp ultimately defeats the evil in the end, albeit by very different means and a very different tone very different style of movie. But she gets what she asks for, and...
But think about it. Joe Pesci, what does Joe Pesci do at the end? He tries to eat Kevin McAllister. He puts his mouth around his finger. And he's going to eat all of his fingers. And what does Nosferatu, spoiler alert,
devours.
He also eats people, which is a bit of a... It's a twist on the vampire thing, where he drinks human blood and eats people. No, actually, it is really cool that the whole... They do a lot of really cool stuff with the vampire iconography, among them being the feeding scenes, both the scene with Nicholas Holt at the beginning and then later on, where he's, like, biting people on the chest and all this other kind of stuff, and that it has a kind of sexual thing where he's, like, convulsing. Feels really cool and unique, and it kind of is, in this weird way, kind of attempting, it kind of speaks to what the whole movie is, which is in that way that there's this kind of parallel or proto-version of Dracula that predates, you know, all of our Bela Lugosi universal concepts of a charming Dracula, etc. It's like, what is the updated version of that energetic thread? What is the updated version of a parallel tract of iconography that doesn't need to be wedded to the iconography of the kind of post-universal Bela Lugosi, Todd Browning, Dracula, blah, blah, blah. And that is... that's good.
That's good. Yeah. I think, yeah, definitely my favorite part of how it was portrayed in this movie, you're kind of hinting at it, is that, you know, there is no more monster that's more played out and tired than the vampire, especially the Dracula vampire. Mm-hmm. We've seen every possible version of it and every possible version of approaching it ironically or in a postmodern way and yada, yada, yada. But to be able to, with this movie, going back to the source, back to the foundation, to actually make a vampire seem like it seemed in the original Dracula novel, as some strange, new, unique creature, the rules of which and the nature of which is mysterious and slowly unfolding. Like the gremlins, if we want to tie everything into it. Gremlin invented a brand new monster with a brand new set of rules, and the fun of the first Gremlins movie is seeing that horror premise slowly unfold in more darker and darker and more interesting ways. And you very much had that sense with this this version of Nosferatu. We weren't quite sure if we're looking at a standard movie vampire, and indeed we are not. We are slowly... Yeah, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's largely drawn from folklore and such in order to give some fresh fresh eyes and a fresh look to the vampire.
Yeah, and before we get in, I want to continue just diving into the story, but some of the big marquee things about this film that are interesting and worth talking about right off the bat is that, A, they completely concealed the appearance of Nosferatu right up until you had to go see the movie to see him, which is great, I think. I mean, just the fact that they had the confidence to do that and it paid off, and the film made, you know, a ton of money over the weekend. The fact that when we went in to see Nosferatu, by that I mean the actual creature itself, it was a quality of discovery. It was a new version of Nosferatu we had not seen before, but one that seems to fit perfectly within what this film was attempting to achieve. A, on the one hand, just from the nerdy film side, it's cool because they're essentially they're filling in kind of the Sergei Eisenstein Ivan the Terrible iconography as Dracula. So Sergei Eisenstein made a film in the 40s about Ivan the Terrible, where he is this big vampiric emperor, and if you don't know anything about Ivan the Terrible, he's essentially Dracula, but he wears gigantic furry oversized things on his shoulders, big, you know, royal cape, and he has this long, pointy mustache and beard and very long, pointy nose. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it uses that iconography, which is interesting just in the context of the history of cinema, because, you know, the first Nosferatu is the marquee example, along with the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, is the marquee example of German expressionism. You know, when we're talking about Tim Burton bringing mm-hmm. back expressionism and stuff in the 90s, we're talking about the idea where even the reality is a bit surreal and expressive mm-hmm. and things are bent and twisted and doors are at angles and it's as if everything is in a surreal nightmare. So people talk about Tim Burton with this kind of lineage to German expressionism, whereas Francis Ford Coppola in Dracula, his film Dracula, of which this film seems to owe quite a debt, and that was a very important film to us in 1990. We didn't talk about Dracula on here very much yet. I don't think. Oh, when we talked about
Megalopolis.
Yeah, that's true. Because I know we had brought it up, but love Bram Stoker's Dracula, and that took the German expressionism and in part replaced it with Japanese expressionism from the 1960s, specifically Masaki Kobayashi's film Kwaidan, which uses the same bat-painted backdrops mm-hmm. and again creates a very surreal and expressive world, but one that is not starkly black and white, but one that is very colorful and is surreal in a completely different kind of way. And then so this film, I didn't know what to go in. It just looks, you know, looked all gothy and shit, you know, from the trailers. And so when I saw Nosferatu, I was immediately pleased because I was like, oh, that's a good idea. That's the kind of idea you hang on to for 10 years and eventually make mm-hmm. is you say, well, what if, all right, how do you take Nosferatu and make him fresh? How do you take Nosferatu, who has essentially become like the shorthand iconography for old vampire in so many shitty movies, whether mm-hmm. it's like Underworld or What We Do in the Shadows? They all have a Nosferatu-looking vampire with the two front teeth and the bald head, and it just means old vampire. And in a world where all vampires are sexy, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
I was honestly expecting, truly, it to be a googly-eyed, because they cast Bill Skarsgård with his googly eyes, a googly-eyed version of Austin Butler from Dune 2. You know, a bald guy who's mostly sexy but has googly eyes, and that he would look a lot like Klaus Kinski in the Werner Herzog film, you know, some variation on that, because that's what they're selling. But then they didn't use that image to sell him at all. It wasn't in the trailers, it wasn't in anything. And when it began to emerge in that soupy, inky blackness at the beginning, his big mustache moving up and down and his long nose, I began to get, like, legitimately excited, because I'm like, oh, this is a good idea, with his big furry shoulders and all this other stuff. Because he looks now like what the idea of Dracula is supposed to evoke. Scary Eastern European shit that we don't understand and goes back a long time, that's just a whole different kind of white people that we don't understand at all and are frightening
to us. I was
going to
say, you keep saying German expression, and I'm probably misunderstanding, but every time I looked at him, I'm like, he looks Russian. He looks...
Oh, sorry, did I misspeak? I meant, yeah, they're switching. So Eisenstein was Russian, mm-hmm. and so German expressionism, Murnau, the first film. Japanese expressionism, Francis Ford Coppola. The Eggers version, Russian expressionism.
Thank you. I was like, Sergei, he looks
Eisenstein.
To me like...
Yes.
Maybe I just don't know my Europeans, but
sorry,
he looked to me a Russian guy.
I probably properly clarify that point, but that was the thing I was trying to point, make out, is that if you look at Eisenstein's Ivan the Terrible, hyper-expressionistic. Everyone, mm-hmm. huge costumes, tall hats, weird twisted angles. It's crazy, but it's mm-hmm. a completely different cinematic space than the Murnau expressionism of Germany, or mm-hmm. it's completely different than, you know, Kobayashi's Kwaidan. Completely different. So a different reference point than Francis Ford Coppola is using. So when I see that iconography of the big furry shoulders and the beard and everything, I love it on two levels. A, because it's a good idea. It looks like what we kind of, if in the book Dracula, presumably he is, which is mm-hmm. something from an older world that doesn't look like our modern world. And that's kind of the association we have with Russia as people in the West.
And is very, what I, amongst many other things, it is, that's great about this approach to his look, is it's coming from a very grounded place. Mm-hmm. It's taking very seriously the backstory of Orlok or Dracula. Mm-hmm. If he was, at, you know, a Romanian or whatever, whatever Eastern European nobleman from ye olden days whose evil enchanter soul has been kept alive by the devil and still exists in some horrible rotted form. That's pretty much what you'd expect. That's the big, the big, the mustache, the fur coat, the everything is a sort of in the most grounded way exactly what you would expect. And it seems like it's such an obvious part of just even grounding the Dracula slash Orlok character within the real world, if you will, within real history, that it's I'm almost surprised no one has ever, it's never occurred to anyone before. It certainly never occurred to me before, so I guess it's good on you, Robert Eggers.
Yeah, no, that's it's an awesome idea, and the second dimension that makes it work really awesome, and then we'll pull Taylor into this conversation, is that it is, in a way that is somewhat unique these days, overtly not sexy. You know, and it's one thing to say that the vampire, oh, we're going to make him super scary. And not
there's a little bit of sexiness in the voice. A little bit of sexiness in the voice.
I will comment on the voice because I disagree.
Oh,
well, there you go. But
Go ahead.
So talk about the voice for a second.
No, I was going to say, because I was like, you're complimentary of his whole look, everything, and his backstory and whatnot. But I like, in a negative way, I like that his voice sounds like a old slurred accent that he's like almost fighting through a lot. I felt like his voice was very warm in a good way, like clearly a very intentional like choice on the part of the actor, but it did give him a little bit of an air of sophistication. You could tell that it was a nobleman, but also he's been so old that it almost felt like it was in pain. Like it almost felt like it hurt him to speak as much.
It's funny and it's interesting. Yeah. You hold your hand right here as you say that, because when we did the episode on Creature from the Black Lagoon, even pointed out the fact that like, but why does he have a double chin? And I was like, well, and we had a whole conversation. Go see our episode on Creature from the Black Lagoon. And what was the other movie that's on the second movie on a two movie thing.
It was a double one.
Creature from the Black Lagoon, I don't think was the thumbnail. Anyway, go look that up. We talked about it at some point. But in that episode, we discussed the idea that this was still during a period, and this is what Nosferatu returns us to, where the monster that wants the girl is still supposed to be scary and not sexy. That is to say, he is supposed to be repulsive. Which is, and this points to something that is unique within this film and that actually gives it a unique power, is that like the acquiescence to desire is punished. The acquiescence to desire to these dark desires is evil, and it is attracts things that are unpleasant when they ultimately work themselves out, which is to say, if in the same way the acquiescence in the modern world to adultery or promiscuity or any sorts of things that we in the old stodgy past thought were immoral, but then we realized weren't that bad, but then you see people who overindulge in their acquiescence to the desire for drugs and alcohol or the desire for sex or be destroyed by them and brought into a world that is very off-putting and monstrous that seems to hover around those things, and that's what... Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, because he brings plague and all this disease everywhere with him, or these rats and whatnot, and I think when the very end, when you see his whole full body without the big cloak on, he has these like big deformities and like, plague pus all over his back. There's no aspect of him that is supposed to be desired other than the fact that it is a dark desire.
Yes, I actually, one thing I was reminded of this, I remember when we were kids, Cliff, you read the book Dracula. This is just popping into my head now. And I remember you said the impression of the book of Dracula in the book is one of a weird alien monster holding up a very thin paper mask in front of his face that says that trying to pretend he's human.
Yes.
And that, I feel like, was achieved very well.
Very
much
so.
Even the idea that his entire back is all bed sores and rot, and he's draped in all these clothes as if he's, again, a horrible monster just showing you enough of his face and staying enough in the dark that at a great distance, like those roaches that look like people in Mimic, you know?
Yeah.
At a great distance, he almost resembles a person. And so, go ahead. Sorry, I'm going to cough.
No, good. That was more or less. I'm actually kind of curious where you're coming from when you're speaking of the voice. It's just a different perspective. You were saying that.
Well, I think just from the first time we, long before we see Dracula, we hear his voice. And the first time we hear his voice is his shockingly deep, shockingly sexy voice that emerges when Lily Rose Depp is praying at the beginning. So it's her Dracula answers her prayer in a foreign language with subtitles, but we understand, she understands what he means. But yes, at that, whenever we hear his voice, it definitely has this just very deep, sensual thing that is clearly seducing her and drawing her in. And then in that same sequence, of course, we see that our first flash of an appearance of the horrible monster that is Dracula, you know, jumping out at her at the end of that sequence. So we see the contrast between those two things. On the, you know, I guess in the on the non-physical plane, there is something seductive about it. It is a spiritual seduction that, and you feel that kind of seduction. You feel her being drawn emotionally, sexually drawn into that before we see that it's just a horrible, rotted, kind of monstrous creature the whole time.
But if there were a continuum between sensuality and horror, wherein the, you know, in the 50s it were way over on the side of horror, and then by the time we get to Francis Ford Coppola, it's way over on the side of sensuality, which then falls off the end into reductio ad absurdum with Twilight. This is way further back into the realm of horror, in the sense that there's just enough sexiness at a distance to make it plausible, but it's that she is tricked, but it's almost portrayed immediately as she begins to convulse and all these other things, that it is more like, you know, Reagan being possessed by a demon in The Exorcist than it is a woman being seduced by a dark man like Billy Zane and Demon Knight, which is playing at the Alamo coming up. I think it's sold out, but we should try and get tickets to Demon Knight if we can. That's one of my favorite movies. We've seen Demon Knight. But as opposed to that guy who is overtly sexy, and even though we see him doing all these horrible things, it's still plausible that he can sexually attract whatever her name is in that movie. And there's or Jerry Dandridge in you know, Fright Night, played by Chris Sarandon, who, you know, even though we see him doing all this horrible stuff,
weird long fingers.
And he has weird long fingers. It is still plausible that he is attractive. And therefore, even though we are seeing the girl being entranced, there is still an indulgent fantasy at work in the idea of kissing Chris Sarandon, being seduced by Billy Zane, etc. Whereas we can see the character being transfixed and seduced by something, but it takes away a significant portion of the indulgent fantasy of, ooh, wouldn't you like to kiss that big rotting mustache? You know, it's like, and again, that's a tough thing. And this is my point with the look, the whole Ivan the Terrible look, and why it's unique. A, it's a good idea in the history of cinema. It's a good idea relative to the Dracula character. But it achieves something that's damn hard to achieve, which is the opposite of sexy. Because the harder you try and achieve the opposite of sexy, for the most part, you just achieve sexy, especially because there's just weird people in the world. You try and take Austin Butler and you cover him in goo and white stuff and make him a weird albino alopecia guy for Dune, that turns sexy. Still worked all of a sudden. So, okay, what do we do? Oh, we're going to take Bill Skarsgård and we're going to turn him into a clown that's got weird makeup and big red hair. And oh no, every girl wants to have sex with the clown? Oh shit. Oh no, I guess. And in a weird way, we all know, and these filmmakers know, they're playing that game because some part of them wants and feels they need that kind of horror talk girl to be like, I think he's the sexiest Pennywise. I'd rather smash the Pennywise that
certified monster fucker.
Exactly. The same thing with it was funny. That's what brought up the Creature from the Black Lagoon thing the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Because we talked about Creature from the Black Lagoon, and then right after we saw Nosferatu, I think you were saying you saw a TikTok where the girl was like, I love this movie, but why couldn't they have made him sexier?
No, it was one of my dark romance authors that I really enjoy was like, oh, we love this movie. This is the closest thing we've ever gotten for these monster fuckers. If only give me Nosferatu, but actually give me Bill Skarsgård. card. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, so
it's
close.
Like, and kind of, and we won't dive into it like we did with the Creature from the Black Lagoon episode, but it's like, that's sort of the point. It's like, we exist in this weird world of just like moral bumper lanes on everything, where it's like, we're told essentially, transgress in whatever way you want, and there will never be any spiritual consequences for you. And anyone who says that, that's just the old world and superstition. And as a result, all of these gothic stories, whether it's Wuthering Heights or Dracula as a horror story, all of these things that were stories of moral consequence in a time when capital M moral just meant sexual, that meant. Their whole the tension that exists between the lived consequences of the acquiescence to turning against your family and, you know, and overindulging in desire or in a hedonistic pleasure, blah 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 blah, has a Newtonian: for every reaction there is an equal but opposite reaction, to bring up Newton again. There is a response within the film. But if you make Bill Skarsgård sexy, and then the girl dies tragically while, like, still looking hot after getting to make out with Bill Skarsgård, within the film itself, there are no consequences. There is no tension, there's no fear. Whereas the idea that she must lay with this grotesque guy with the mustache, I mean, it's, again, if it were Pennywise the Clown, girls would be more into it. But something about that weird droopy mustache and his weird long nose and everything make him seem like a character that the film wanting you to fuck is not a part of what's making the film work. And that's wholly unique among pretty much, well, any Bill Sarsgaard movie. Yeah. Let me put whatever the fuck is how you pronounce his last name. And very unique among certainly any vampire movie in the last few years, who kind of feels they need, that's the juice, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't have a bunch of girls showing up wanting to fuck the vampire, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's what I said.
By the way, I did figure out while watching this movie why Bill Skarsgård was not cast as Fade Rautha, which would have seemed the obvious pick.
Because he's the nephew and everything.
Yeah, because he's at least a foot and a half taller than Timothy Chalamet. Whereas Austin Butler and him, more at the same height. Yeah, I don't think the fight would have worked with him fighting a midget fighting a giant So that wouldn't have quite been pulled off.
Wouldn't quite have done it. Yeah. Oh, fun.
Pin that for if we ever need a David and Goliath story, though.
Exactly.
So, finally, now, 30 minutes in that we've done teeing up Nosferatu, we can get into it a little bit more, but So basically, the story of the movie is Dracula, obviously, and I'm sure Willem Dafoe's character has a name that's not Van Helsing, but we're just going to call him Van Helsing because I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the original Nosferatu was a copyright ripoff of Dracula when Dracula was not yet in the public domain because it came out like, you know, 30 years prior, when it was still a current novel, which seems weird.
Yes, exactly. It was a contemporary book. It was kind of knocked off where they changed the names into Nosferatu. Not the first vampire film at all, but
the first adaptation of Dracula, I think, in cinematic form, where we have Count Orlok, and it's set in Germany, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, and kind of, as we said before, this film certainly leans into all of the we haven't talked about any of this is Robert Eggers, who played, I don't want to undersell him as having had a somewhat important role in this film.
Isn't he the director?
He's the director. Okay. I'm joking.
Just confirming.
No. This is his fourth film. Third one produced by Chris Columbus. I don't think Chris Columbus produced The Northman. I really enjoyed The Witch, you know, when it came out. I saw The Lighthouse, I think, at Fantastic Fest when it came out. It was the only time I saw it. I haven't really thought of it much since. It didn't make a tremendous impression on me.
I remember a lot of the visuals and whatnot, but it's one of those films that felt too experimental and weird to really kind of hold together coherently.
Yeah, and I really like a lot of what is in The Northman. I mean, especially if you look at any episode of our podcast, we literally have nothing but a gigantic shelf of Conan the Barbarian books, including some of these old Conans. Mm-hmm. That's focused.
And it's in that first Conan compilation where indeed you have the Finding the Sword in the Mound, which is the sequence that is just riffed in
the Northman. Yeah, that whole sequence in the Northman where he goes and he finds the sword and takes it from the skeletal guy and he gets up and fights with the skeletal king is all like right from the early from. But that story happens when Conan is a boy. It's kind of part of his origin, that's the interesting thing about the Northman. For as much as I like about it, you know, it's all about ancient warrior peoples doing psychedelics and a bunch of shit ripped off from Conan and witchcraft and all the shit I'm super into, it again failed to make much of an impression on me. I didn't think much about it. I was trying to remember stuff about it the other day and I was like, holy shit, was Nicole Kidman in that movie? Like, I forgot completely that she played Lady Macbeth in the movie. So it's one of those things where in retrospect, what I dug about Nosferatu by contrast to Northman, something, it's subject matter. I mean, Jesus Christ, Cliff, Jack, dude, swords, that's kind of our bread and butter. Have you seen the shelf of Conan books? We were excited about that movie, it felt a bit more like a art film kind of with the production design backdrop of a sword and sorcery film, like, you know, a really expensive perfume commercial or fashion shoot where the aesthetic that the art director was bringing was barbarian, you know. But there wasn't an actual movie that happened while we were sitting there watching that actually took me anywhere. And what I like about this is, as much as I, you know, have Robert Eggers' very, you know, Kubrick core, symmetrical, screensavery looking frames, I feel it can be a little annoying even in this film. Like, there's so many times where it's just so slavish to them, like when Nicholas Holt is running to Lily Rose Depp at the beginning and it's just that really dumb close-up on his face, and I'm just like, just pull the camera back, show me more of your world so it doesn't look like it was generated by ChatGPT. But anyway, as much as all that is the case, it felt like there was a real movie and story actually moving through this movie as it was being made. There was an actual, you know, the relationship between Nicholas Holt's Jonathan Harker and Lily Rose Depp's Winona Ryder, really is written very traditionally. That is to say, they have their tragic goodbye moment right before she gives up. Their love is allowed to actually see itself expressed in the beginning of the film. They're just a young couple. They're on their honeymoon. They're fucking a bunch. Blah, blah, blah. He goes off to work to a thing. I like that that's from, I think, it's been a long time since I've seen the original Nosferatu, but there's the thing where she anticipates the fact that he's going to get the job and already get called away and all that with her psychic.
It was in the Werner Herzog version. I don't remember if it was in the original version.
Yeah, I knew it had, we had seen it somewhere before. But and that glue holds together all of the Robert Eggers, weird symmetrical arty framing and surrealism and all of that. Like, I like how the film looks when there is an actual story pulling me through the whole thing. There was something for me to invest in. There were choices the characters were making that were paying off in consequential ways and developing over the course of the movie emotionally, and it actually, like, brought me into it and made me give a shit about the sacrifice that Lily Rose Depp was going to make to save everybody and blah, 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 because I was legitimately afraid of Dracula and what he was going to do to her. And I've only seen the film once at this point, but I feel like it made already a tremendous, its story, its characters, the narrative we saw play out made a much bigger impression on me than his last couple films. And what do you guys think?
Well, yeah, I agree on definitely on that level of next to The Witch, this is his best movie, I think it's right in there because he's, well, like The Witch, trying to do a traditionally good horror movie in a fairly straightforward way, despite all of the arty Kubrickian whatever affectations around it. It's still fundamentally, you know, The Witch. Though what was fun about The Witch is it was such a back-to-basics witch movie. This is a back-to-basics vampire movie that made a witch, which really isn't even really a scary horror movie character. We associate that more with Wizard of Oz than anything. I mean, Wicked is playing now. Look at the silly singing flying witches. And made it seem like a genuinely horrifying, Lovecraftian monster of unknown origins and unknown mysterious power that you are drawn into. And this is very much the same with Nosferatu. It did the witch thing for the vampire.
Yeah. I definitely agree. You did raise a really good point, which is Nosferatu, you know, is a horror film that absolutely delivers all the goods of a horror film. Whereas The Lighthouse, say,
still not sure what's going on with The Lighthouse.
Exactly. The Lighthouse, you know, feels like whatever it was, not really a horror film, commits the cardinal sin of having a monster in the trailer that's just a dream sequence in the movie. And then with The Northman, if The Northman had been an action movie, if it had understood that it was an action movie and delivered us some actual action beats over the course of the film, then I think we could have... I think it would have left a significantly stronger impression than it did. Because at the end, I mean, from what I'm recalling, a lot of guys clanging swords together artily while flexing their muscles against a fiery backdrop, that weird long shot.
That's all we really need.
There you go. Hey, trust me.
Out of the three movies, The Northman is my favorite. Not Nosferatu. There's a different movie, but I really enjoy The Northman.
There you go. No, hey, I'm all for. Literally, that's why we give out the Full Metal Jacked awards. I'm all for jacked dudes clanging swords together. But again, I don't remember anything that happened in The Northman in any of the action sequences. I remember much, much more from the action beats of, you know, what is it, Arthur Pune's Sword and the Sorcerer or Deathstalker or any of those movies. I can remember things that happened in the action of those films. And I think the action in The Northman feels like it was a bit of an afterthought. It was more about the production-designed affectation of an art film. Mm-hmm. You can feel that in how
you're not wrong in that. It's definitely, you know, definitely maybe art over substance. But I enjoyed watching it, and I would watch it again.
But that's my point. Is I felt the same way when I left the theater, and yet I've never felt compelled to watch The Northman a second time. Mm-hmm. Whereas I already am hungry, no pun intended, to go back and see Nosferatu a second time. I do like that line. I am an appetite and nothing else. Just great lines in this movie. I like the script. Mm-hmm. I like a lot of... And I don't know from all the different sources that they would be drawing from for this, whether any of it is taken from the book or the original film or the Herzog thing or all the different sources they're drawing from. But was a big fan of how the concept was approached. Conceptually, the concept was approached philosophically, how the film sets itself against the backdrop of a plague now in the post-2024. Again, this is Dracula, this is Nosferatu, this is the Werner Herzog film. It's perennially relevant, but far...
And then that, by the way, is more one of the things, the plague rats and all that is distinctive to the Nosferatu concept. That's not really present in the Dracula novel at all. And so that's definitely one of the through lines for all the Nosferatu adaptations, is connecting them to the plague and to rats.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, just one of the few things I know about Nosferatu is that his OG inspiration for his design was to make him more animalistic and more rat-like, and that is actually why the iconic like bald head with two fangs is because they're supposed to be like little rat fangs.
Yeah, which is in that needle is threaded into Dracula quite well by Francis Ford Coppola as well, who literally makes Gary Oldman a Japanese rat priest samurai at the beginning of the thing, and he gives him the butt head, but is really two giant rat ears in his bun, and gives him that long rat tail going down. So he achieves the idea of human rat in an expressionistic way, but does it. And he obviously turns into rats in the movie and does all this other stuff. But it turns him into a human rat in a way that is a completely different image, completely different set of iconography from the Murnau version. And this, I think, is another great version of that, where you can see him with his mustache is like rat whiskers and with his big furry shoulders and everything. Yeah. He is a rat, but he is a rat in a completely different way than the two previous... those two previous
which
versions.
Again, I'll throw a point out, which would, for me visually, what really stuck out to me was just the unafraidness of showing all of the disease on his back, because you see his spindly hands, you see his claws, you see his, you know, weird face most of the movie, and then at the very end you see that he himself is plagued and has like these big you know, hardened pustules and like or even, almost like barnacles
almost like
things.
Bed sores from laying in his coffin rot. That kind of conflates all those things together.
And like when we first, that's, you know, iconic scene in all of the Nosferatu adaptations is when Jonathan Harker in the castle finds the Dracula coffin and busts it open to see him laying in the coffin before he then sits up. And it's very shocking when we see Nosferatu and see Orlok in the coffin, that how much of that he is just a rotting corpse. He's just a rotting corpse being eaten by rats, essentially, in this coffin, and then suddenly it comes to life. And that is unique.
Yes. I really like, A, the whole sequence where Nosferatu is introduced, but I especially liked seeing the following sequence of Harker waking up in that space, seeing that space in the daylight, and then him going to try and put the pickaxe through chest. What I dug about that is, A, it was funny. I was literally watching that scene, and I said, I had this phrase in my head, and I was like, oh, cool. It's like a little bit of an homage to Legend in here with the big columns and the huge, the Ridley Scott film and the gigantic inset floor fireplace. It's like, say, and then I literally had this thought. I thought, but I'm sure if you ask the filmmaker, he'll say, I wasn't inspired by Legend. I was inspired by Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, which is our mutual source of inspiration. And literally, we were listening to an interview with Chris Columbus just prior to this where he says, well, the film draws a lot from Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, so which was obviously a big reference point for Legend. But we enter this space with all these black columns and this big inset floor fireplace, and our cat, Mr. Parker, who's decided to join because he heard us talking about rats. Come on, Mr. Parker, you can come in here. But we enter this space where Nosferatu is slowly introduced, his big booming voice, his amorphous shape. He sits down. I love Nicholas Hoult is just rippling with fear the whole time. Like, there's so much storytelling going on Nicholas Hoult's face the whole time. And that's really true. I mean, I was really impressed with Lily Rose Depp. I was really impressed with everyone's commitment. But you just have to have, everyone does an amazing job because everyone is radiating with fear and storytelling in a way that sells. And again, they're doing this in a context where they're on set. There's not all the booming sound design and all of the stuff that's there that for the character on screen is occasioning all of their horror. They're fucking bringing
every time
it hard. And to say nothing of Lily Rose Depp's big exorcist freak out moment, which is really impressive later on, which we can get into.
Or like puppeteer movement, yeah.
But the whole of that space, the whole of that scene is dependent upon a lack of being able to see that space. Of it being surreal, of it being inky black, of it being nothing. You can't see anything. And then we then get the visual reveal of when he awakes the next morning and sees it in full light. A, we get to see it in full light, and he's still laying there. B, we see that it is not so much a room within a house as it is a ruin. There's literally, it's just like an open space, and there's dust on the ground, and it looks like an old castle that it had to be that dark in that scene. It had to be that dark to deceive him that he was in the home of a real human person. It's not nice and well appointed, and he's pouring him wine and there's candles burning and stuff. Like, it was again, not unlike Dracula, the minimal affectation, a fire in this room and no additional light to convince this human person that he was actually in a human home.
Just barely convinced.
For about 10 seconds.
Exactly.
go ahead.
No, just unimportant, but also just like, as soon as he gets there, it's like, and we have to sign this paperwork now because in the morning, none of this is going to be here.
Yeah. No, that's, and he wakes up the next morning and we get to see that whole space exactly like in the daylight. And then he gets up and he finds him in his coffin, and then he stands up. Again, a moment that feels somewhat informed by the Francis Ford Coppola film when he's up in his big monstrous form, standing up in the coffin.
I think this is the classic, you know, in Nosferatu where you see the shot of him, you know, just stiff as a board, just standing up and rising up in his coffin. Mm-hmm. That's the moment, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is... I love that sequence. I love Jonathan Harker or Nicholas Hoult, whatever the character's name is in this movie, working his way back to her over the course of the leaping out of the thing and all that other kind of crazy stuff. And the rest of the cast is very strong. We have Bald Girl from Deadpool Wolverine plays the other girl.
Did not recognize her for the runtime of the movie because of the lack of baldness. She's not bald in this movie.
Yeah. Her name is probably Emma because she's British. She's but she's bald in Deadpool Wolverine, and she's very, very good in this as the other girl who isn't Winona Ryder, yeah. The other one. And
her, like, best, her childhood friend yeah. or something.
Childhood friend. And then,
yeah. I couldn't quite catch their relationship to mm-hmm. the family, other than they were just very friendly. But yeah, yeah.
No, they were clearly very close friends. And then what is it? And then Aaron Taylor Johnson plays her husband, who plays the cold rationalist who is her yes. husband. And that is, if we kind of get into the movie and we get into the once the story... our cat just freaked out.
He sees a bird out. Or a lizard or something.
That's right. Once the story is underway, and we now know that Dracula, that Nosferatu is inbound to London or wherever the hell they live. Where do they
some
live in Germany?
German town.
Yeah, some German town. Doesn't matter. But now that Nosferatu is inbound and communicating with Lily Rose Depp.
Nicholas Hoult's boss.
Yes, that's right. Psychically. Yes, that's right. The Renfield character. That's one twist I really do like about Nosferatu, is that in the same way that like the Hammer horror version of Dracula like updates the story in kind of a cool way by having Jonathan Harker shows up there, but he's secretly there to kill Dracula right from the beginning, and he reveals that he knows Dracula's Dracula, and he reveals he's, and it's like you're like, so it immediately starts Dracula in this whole different place with that character, and what's the deal? I don't know what's going on. Nosferatu, and I think this is in the original 30s film as well, the character of Renfield, the guy who is the, you know, the familiar of Dracula who's mm-hmm. going crazy, the Tom Waits going nuts, is the guy, the boss who sends him on the thing. And is that not the case in the original Dracula film as well? Or he works for the company, but it's not, you don't see him prior to that.
Yeah, yeah, he works at, like in the Bram Stoker's Dracula, it is referenced by his boss.
Oh, yes, that's right.
That
that's right,
Mr. Renfield was right, the first right. agent we sent to Dracula. Yeah, yeah, and then he came back and was
but
insane.
Just having
but it just yeah cuts yeah. It simplifies it just you know well, simplifies
the, this is the unique part is this which is the opening scene wherein you get the sense that you get to actually see Renfield on screen operating as the kind of confederate of Dracula as he sends the Jonathan Harker character off to his doom. He is, and what I like about this is right in the beginning of the film, obviously, our psychic Lily Rose Depp is trying to. What's the character's name?
Mina. Mina? It's not probably it's not Mina.
It's probably not Mina. It's something else.
It was Mina and the other one.
We're going to call her Lily. Lily Rose Depp's character anticipates he's going to be called away. He is called away, but you see the clearly the subtextual ulterior motives of his Renfield boss talking about the beauty of his wife and how she's almost like a sprite or a nymph or something like
that. Sylph,
I
believe
yes,
he concludes.
There you go. Yeah, I don't even know what that is.
It's similar. It's yeah. just sylph, nymph. They're all basically different parts of the nature.
Yeah, I like it. And then as he goes to put something away, we then of course see the literal Faustian contract. Oh, by the way, in the opening scene, the cat's name is Goethe. Isn't that funny? Goethe wrote Faust. So then we see the Faustian contract there with the seven-pointed star on it, and he like covers it up with a piece of paper so that Jonathan Harker can't see it. But he's clearly working to separate this man from this woman already for the purposes of this Dracula getting a hold of her. Mm-hmm. And like that is mm-hmm. already where we're beginning in this film, as opposed to even in the Bram Stoker version, the Francis Ford Coppola version, where it takes Jonathan Harker by fate and circumstance going to Dracula before he then sees the amulet and realizes that his love has been reincarnated as Winona Ryder mm-hmm. and goes to seek her out. So what I like about this is there's a even more ominous foreboding of a kind of Cthulhu cult conspiracy at work. You know, even his new employment and all of this is arranging his separation from his mm-hmm. wife so that she can be fed to Dracula, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And that adds a cool kind of, you know, thing to it that I just really dig that a lot. But once it's underway, and we now know that Jonathan he's gone initially, he eventually returns, people are dying off, there's these afflictions that keep cursing what's her head, and so they seek out, because they have her tied to the bed, Van Helsing, played by Willem Dafoe, and And this is where things get interesting, because if you when we then get the Willem Dafoe character playing the very explicit and overt alchemist,
occultist
and alchemist, yes, who is highly influenced by what's his dick says, you dare not say, the works of Agrippa. So we pulled out our Agrippa here so that we could scry the Agrippa later instead of just doing the tarot draw. Because he is this alchemist, we have one metaphysical view of the world, a metaphysical view that is not less intellectual, but is one that is very allowing for the idea of spirits and monsters and things that are not of modernity, you know, those very old things to which Dracula is a part. And then you have the Aaron Taylor-Johnson character, who, by contrast, is the pure rationalist. And what I love, and this is beautiful, and takes on a resonant power in the year 2024 that was even felt by the whole audience, you know, it got a little bit of a charged reaction from the audience, is he says aloud, there is a real plague going on. It's a real plague, and real people are dying, and you guys are talking about all of your, you know, spirits and all of that. And what do we have more now in this kind of emergent spiritual moment in the zeitgeist than kind of the cool rationalists of the world who use disease and use, you know, science and use the kind of over medicalization of the entire world to try and, to borrow the kind of the Richard Tarnas terminology, disenchant the world. There is only the things that are real, and if you believe in things that are spiritual or ephemeral, if you believe in things that are divine, then you believe in fairy tales and you are crazy. And they even say that you know, the Willem Dafoe character has been run out of his profession and has a ill reputation, and we meet him, he is of course trying to scry the stars, and because he has misread them, he believes that the gods will not turn his black sulfur into gold this time. And I don't know, it's like this reemergent interest in alchemy is very cool, because in a weird way, that's part of the reason we're doing this podcast, is the idea that there is something unseen about the idea of a movie theater. That a movie theater, yes, it is a building, and it is a place where you project images on a screen. It is a place where people see media, but there's something that seems to be lost as we go from 35 millimeter to digital projection. And there's something else unseen that seems to be lost when we go from seeing things in a movie theater with 200 strangers to seeing them alone at home. There's something that...
on that note, though, was Nosferatu last night on 35?
Yeah, it was shot and projected. It had the little burn. Projected in 35 millimeter, which is great. We should have mentioned that at the beginning.
No, I get very excited when we watch movies now and I see that little circle in the middle, and I'm like,
that's great. So, but there's something that has been lost, some part of the unseen world that is being lost, and I feel like we have multiple concepts for what the mind is, and we just exist in a world where we think of the mind. We have created a talismanic representation for what the mind is with the computer, that the mind is just a thing that processes vast quantities of data. It is just takes in datum, factual datum that are quantifiable, and processes massive amounts of datum, and that if we ever have a computer that can process way more data than a person, well, that computer is just going to wake up and start writing poetry and waxing philosophical.
But all the while, we forget that the entire modern view of the mind is just a metaphor.
Yes.
There isn't anything really scientific about the scientific worldview. The mind as a computer is just a metaphor. And as they continue to plug away at this AI thing, and it won't ever wake up. Spoiler alert, everybody. It won't ever wake up. We understand that that metaphor, the metaphors that the modern scientific worldview has, you know, the metaphors of the world that we are supposed to live in and understand break down and are perhaps less useful as metaphors than these very same occult alchemical metaphors for explaining what's actually going on.
Yeah, well, take this as an idea. Young's dreams, visions, whatever, his memoir, which I've been reading recently, he talks about a vision he had of a past life wherein he lived in a castle and was an alchemist who had a very secret room in the basement of this castle. That, and this, the reason I'm saying all of this is this entire dream, I realize, is a completely alternate metaphor for what the mind is and what humans are and what our souls are, that then lays perfectly into the Willem Dafoe character, just to kind of give some perspective here. But Jung talks about this idea of a castle that has a spiral of copper wire running out through its central column into the air, just into the ether, and it's tightly coiled, he said, so that it's as big as a tree, but it's made of all these copper wires that are tightly wound to the point where it's just a solid piece, but then they, like roots or like the branches of a tree, unwind, and when they get above the castle, spiral into many antennas reaching out into the ether, and that by a royal secret that Jung remembers knowing, but that it was very important that no one else know, that it was his job to be the master of drawing energy down through those copper wires and turning them into gold coins. That very slowly, the purpose of the whole castle and the land around it and everything was to facilitate this process by which energy would be drawn down from the heavens and turned slowly into gold. And what do we see Willem Dafoe doing when we first meet him? He is literally trying to turn black sulfur, the blackest black, if you will, where the film is, into gold. And in terms of, there's, of course, this idea now that all alchemy is metaphorical. That is to say, when the ancients and the Hermeticists were talking about transmuting baser elements into gold, it was entirely about transforming the soul from its baser, more animalistic self into the enlightenment of light and realizing that you were a part, a segment of God, blah, 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 blah. But also, as above, so below, them being the most important metaphysic or hermetic principle, what if it also was about making actual gold? Mm-hmm. And again, as we're beginning to realize that maybe science doesn't know quite as much about the baser element, about all elements, as it purports to know, we begin to realize that maybe these things, even transmuting baser elements into gold, is not only possible physically within reality these days, but is apparently may have even been possible back then through transmutation and alchemy. And if that's true, then another quote comes to mind from Willem Dafoe within this movie, which I absolutely love. I've only seen the movie one time, but it's already stuck in there. He says something to the effect of, we are not so much enlightened, haha, enlightenment, but we are not so much enlightened as we are blinded by the gaseous cloud of science. And that, to use Richard Tarnas's metaphor of the two suitors, you know, if you approach the world as if it is full of mysteries with deference and like that, like the High Priestess card, like the High Priestess, like Lily Rose Depp, it will reveal, it will blossom, like the rose, also in her name. It will blossom and reveal itself to you.
Her name is also Lily.
Yes, exactly. So two flowers, and the spirits will reveal themselves to you, just like what happened with her, just like what's happening with Willem Dafoe. But if you do not court the universe and you reject its mysteries, you will be entirely blind to them, as we see all of these signs afflicting the Aaron Taylor Johnson character, dark omens, all of these things. But he is the cool rationalist. You guys are talking about nonsense. Obviously, I have to move these people out of my house, blah, blah, blah. And because there's a plague, a real plague, science, enlightenment, reason going on. And as a result, both of his children and wife are eaten by Nosferatu, and then he fucks his dead wife, Taylor.
No, that's the only thing I... Step up to the plate. No, that is the only thing I knew about going into the movie was all the goth horror girls being like, I totally get it, Aaron. I mean, to be overwhelmed with love.
Yeah.
It was tamer than I... Honestly, it was funny because it was much tamer when I saw it. I was like, oh, that's nothing. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was cool, but you were expecting... So you knew that he was going to...
It was the only thing I knew. I expected like a real scene, like a really uncomfortable... Because the reactions were as if it was like on screen for a long time. Yeah. Everyone's looking around each other.
To be honest, I didn't come away from the film with the impression that he had had sex with her. I see in retrospect that that was
because her leg is hiked up and he's dead on top of her.
I see now that that's the implication, and in a weird way that kind of echoes what's about to happen with Nosferatu and what's her bitch. But so I do get that. But honestly, to be honest, when I was watching the film the first time, I see him kiss the dead wife. I see him dead there later on. But I didn't see enough even visually to indicate to me that they had had sex. But
no, it was truly that leg hike that was doing all of the implications.
I'm sure it's probably there and I just missed it. No. But if the internet is on fire with the idea of Aaron Taylor Johnson necrophilia, then I'm here for it.
I'm not here to deny that that's going on. No, so overwhelmed by love.
It's the ultimate end of his rationalist point of view. Because you're a rationalist, you don't think there is such a thing as a soul. You just think we are pieces of meat. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he couldn't resist. He kept talking about how his wife, how beautiful she was. Couldn't resist her. And at a time when plainly her soul is absent and it's just cold meat, the depths of his final insanity are to try to fuck the cold meat. That's a really good point.
I knew it had something. It's the ultimate kind of expression of materialism that, as far as he is concerned, her body is her. If we live in a world without gods or demons, we live in a world without souls. So, and just like we saw in Frankenstein, the novel, like the reanimation of the flesh being the goal, the perverse goal of the materialists. So rather than striking her with lightning, he actually tries to make love to her body as if it is her, only further debasing and destroying himself ultimately, blah, blah, blah. He dies, presumably, of having caught the plague from her or something, even though it is
We see him lean over her at first, he coughs blood.
That's true. He is already
dying from the plague at the time, blah, blah, blah.
No, that's all very good. No, I like all that. So we have our rationalist, we have our alchemist who sees this magical world and sees this modernity, and also is the only character, therefore, who sees the extreme loneliness, and we are made to now understand the loneliness in an esoteric context, in a character context, of Lily Rose Depp's character at the beginning of the movie. Why is she calling out to any being of any celestial sphere? Because in an entirely disenchanted world, those with a feminine inclination, a spiritual inclination, those who are attuned to seeing the spiritual dimension of life feel profoundly lonely if you don't see any reflection of it in the world around you. So she reaches out into the world of night for anything that reflects this spiritual longing, and she finds, because there's no positive influences around her spiritually, she finds something very, very, very dark that is born of her own spiritual naivete. And as Willem Dafoe says, in another age you would have been a great priestess of Isis. That idea that if she had been existed in another context, all of these same people who are literally tying her to a bed and opposing her and trying to shut her down, etc., would be
that whole scene with her and Aaron is like, why do you hate me? I tried to help you. You tied me up.
Yeah, well, think about the difference between how she's tied to the bed, but in the gypsy community at the beginning, they have a naked virgin aloft on a horse, a white horse, and are carrying her aloft through the cemetery to protect them or whatever. Now, think about that. Those two images, very important. Because she was born in the post-Enlightenment world of rationalism, everyone responds to her gifts, her insights, or whatever, as if they are of the devil and a medical malady, a psychological malady. So she is literally tied down to the bed and made to not do these things anymore. As opposed to the girl who probably is also has young virginal spiritual instincts in the gypsy community, who is raised aloft like a priestess of Isis on top of a horse and led through to protect them. They see that her spiritual instincts are valuable, that they are that there are dark things that lurk in that forest, and by having this young girl and all the types of things she can see and draw, it actually is a weapon against that darkness. And what is a young girl like her with those powers in the world of the Enlightenment, in Germany, in London? What is she? just a fucking kook, just a fucking problem, just a patient. And that's all she is. She's a patient. And so we have taken a world where, and this is brought more broadly applicable to the world we live in, where, you know, cities like Los Angeles are covered with hundreds and hundreds of crazy people on the streets talking to themselves, blah, blah, blah. Try hundreds of thousands of people on the streets talking to themselves and whatever, is that we now have created a world where there are, we pretend that there's no people with spiritual intuitions, and we pretend that there's no people with second sight, and yet suddenly out of nowhere, we just have thousands and thousands upon thousands of people who are mental health patients and have mental health issues and hear voices and neuroses that they need to stop. And so instead, the rationalist, the person who quantifies, does not want things to be qualitative and ambiguous and chaotic and dark and of the night. They want everything to be the same. They want every day to be the same. Because again, the rationalist needs everything divided into square units. And so we medicate ourselves and we drink caffeine in the morning and we take Adderall and we take SSRIs and we take all of this bullshit to try and even ourselves out so that not even a whisper of these troubling thoughts, not even a whisper of the spirits, not even a whisper of that wind that was reaching out to Kevin McAllister in Home Alone, or that spirits that Lily Rose Depp is tuning into, so that not a whisper from the mouth of God can enter your head. It is all, it's like, no, you're not spiritually inclined. You don't have an instinct. You are a mental patient. You are blah, 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 blah. And I think that is why this metaphor specifically, I think, is a very potent one these days, because we live in a world where certainly basically every woman in America has been turned into a perennial patient. She's constantly going on to the doctor. She's on three medications. Women are much more medicated even than men, though men are increasingly higher medicated on, you know, on everything from Adderall to SSRIs to all of this bullshit. Men, women are extremely medicated. They are treated as patients by our rational world. And then at the same time, we are told that all of our instincts, that maybe there is something more that our world missed, can't be addressed right now. And why can't they be addressed right now? Because there's a plague. There's a real plague. There's a real plague out there in the world, and real people are dying, and you people are talking about ISIS. Well, I guess people are talking about ISIS of a different kind these days in the political context. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but yes, anyway, that's what I dig about Nosferatu, is I dig the fact that this idea that is kind of implicit in all horror movies, this metaphysical idea. The metaphysical idea, and quite frankly, to give Robert Eggers a lot of credit, the same metaphysical idea that's at work in the background of a movie like The Shining. That idea that what is most horrifying about The Shining is just that there is a spiritual dimension to the world. You know, it is a world where we see that if you really lean in, and even Paranormal Activity is another film that does a great job, that even Paranormal Activity's lack of production design, lack of lights, the fact that it's all shot in a digital camera, so effectively creates the banality of reality. That rhymes. The banality of reality that we feel violated when a demon steps into that space. The banality of the hotel in The Shining. The fact that it looks like a ski lodge you just might go to. It doesn't look like a spooky ski lodge. The fact it feels like the type of scenario a person in the modern world who has a kid and maybe has an ex-wife and maybe drinks too much might find themselves in. And we ground ourselves to that, to the point where when metaphysically we begin stripping that away and we begin to conflate those lines between how much of his drinking is him and how much of it is he has taken possession of by a demon. And to even consider that question in the modern world makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And that is the key to, well, to the uncanny in general in art and in whatever, but that is the key to the metaphysical dilemma that not only underscores all horror movies and underscores the very genesis of horror in the early 20th century, you know, the idea of Dracula penetrating this new rationalist modernity we have, but is an idea that has never been more vital than now, where the very people who are attempting to kind of expunge all spirituality and disenchant the world are carrying as their banner plagues and science and two snakes wrapped around the world, and it's coming slowly across the sea on a big ship, and what are we going to do other than shove a big iron stake through its heart? And by the way, that's another cool thing as well, the fact that they use an iron stake to kill, which makes Dracula, which also works on the level, because what is, I mean, alchemy is the science of kings. You know, it is drawing metal from stones, and specifically the secret of kings, like King Arthur, the sword and the stone, is the drawing of steel from a rock. And so steel, iron, is this implement of modernity. We live in an iron age, and therefore to defeat this creature, they have to use an implement that is both the secret of kings, the sword drawn from the stone by King Arthur, but also the thing that is now anti-spiritual, the thing that is the garlic or sunlight to the vampire, is the very thing that we have used to build our rails and our skyscrapers and all of that other kind of stuff. And that's reflected in a lot of magic stuff, like in Leprechaun Part 2, where it is wrought iron that burns the leprechaun. Yeah.
And it is, but it is noteworthy that in this movie, Nosferatu, the iron bar is completely ineffective and is not used to kill Dracula in any way. And indeed, the
Nevertheless, they use an implement of the modern age.
Oh, sure, that is the false attempt to kill Dracula with the implement of the modern age, when in fact he is killed by the girl.
Yes, he is killed by the priestess of Isis, by the sun, and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, no.
They kill the shit out of Renfield with that iron bar.
They do. They do. Oh, yes. That is a fun beat as well. No, I do dig the. The guy who played Renfield, that was good.
I could see him playing a good Smee as like a Captain Hook.
That's a good point, actually. I like that. We watched Hook not too long ago, which in a weird way feels of a piece with Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula in some way. I don't know why. Completely
unrelated, but it is a Hook and Peter Pan, especially, is one of those stories that just gets retold a lot in like the books that I read. It's one of the easiest. Make Peter Pan the villain, make Hook the sympathetic one, or you know, give a twist on the story of what Peter Pan is, you know, blah blah. And I could see a story where it's this similar archetype, but just Peter Pan, this like boy who like floats around and you know just takes children away, etc.
Or doing it as a
sure. I can see the same Renfield as a Smee-esque character.
I like that. I like that a lot. What else do we need to talk about? So we talk about the fact that at the end Willem Dafoe advises her essentially, and I do dig, like, we build and we build and we build towards Nosferatu eats Aaron Taylor Johnson's family after first appearing in the flesh, or in the dream, but in the flesh to Lily Rose Depp's character, and telling her that she has 3 days. And each night, if she does not give herself to him willingly, he is going to kill off people she loves. And the first night kills off her nieces and sister or whatever, friend and the daughters and all of that, which is a very scary, cool sequence. Aaron Taylor Johnson then dies from having sex with his dead wife after that. Everyone is dying off, so she volunteers herself. She sacrifices herself. And just like in the Herzog film, there is that implication that by giving herself to him and seducing him and loving him, and that is what is explicitly stated, is by choosing to love him, by the, again, a great idea even on an esoteric level, that what finally expunges the darkness, and what is he but extinguishes the darkness, is light, the light of God, the light of the sun, and what is light but love? And that idea that she has to love this creature, and in the instant that she loves him, on a practical level, it's what seduces him and draws him to stay there. He's feeding on her. She says, more, more, which has a double meaning. It's both sexual and whatever. She says, more. He takes more blood from her, and is kept there until the sun rises. But by giving herself to him willingly, and by loving him, then the appetite but nothing else that he is, the thing that is anathema to love and light, has all of its power stripped away instantly. And that is the greatest indictment of the post-Enlightenment, post-Industrial Revolution world, is these things, like in this movie, that we see the rationalists deploying all of this energy to try and stopping the boat. You see the guys on the boat try and kill Nosferatu, and he fucking eats their heads because they're coming after him with axes and other things made of steel. They get to the shore and they're trying to catch him and trying to do all this other shit. All of these implements are being deployed utterly ineffectively to stop this all-powerful thing, this darkness that is beyond their ability to reckon with it, right up until she loves it. And the moment she loves the thing, it's gone instantly. The power is gone. And so, and that, in addition to just being, you know, obviously the dramatic underpinnings of a lot of this kind of gothic-y shit, that is the indictment of the modern age, is that we are deploying all of these steel rods to try and vanquish the problems that were created by previous steel rods, while all the while taking the people who might have solutions to these problems, or might say, hey, maybe we threw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, maybe we should focus a little bit more on why the sun and the moon are the same size in the sky, and why everyone hears the same voices whispering to them in the night, and all of that, and there might be a solution to all of these problems in something we left behind. And it takes all of that and shows that the monster is entirely of our own creation. Nosferatu is something dark and esoteric, but he is our appetite. That's what he says. He is our shadow. He is our appetite. He is those things that are attached to the demiurgical, that are attached to manifest reality and want more and to take of it with greater hunger, an insatiable hunger that cannot be fed. And what is modernity? What is the Terminator and all of the the paperclip maximizer we discussed in our episode about the Terminator and AI, but an appetite, nothing more, absent consciousness. And so when she floods it with, and another metaphor for light in addition to love is being consciousness, by just becoming conscious of it and flooding it with love and light, it's vanquished effortlessly. It dies. It becomes just this, you know, weird skeleton thing.
Shriveled up legs.
With shriveled up legs. And we kind of exist in that same moment where there's all of the, where people are turning against each other and biting each other, and there's, and arguing over who should have the right to send salvos of disease or salvos of bombs or salvos of spiritual hatred at other people, and we're all fighting, but maybe there is something that would extinguish this behemoth, extinguish this Leviathan, that's as effortless as the sunrise, that is as effortless as love, that is as effortless as all of those things, and we just refuse to acknowledge it, and we instead, we tie it to a bed, and we then say, there's a real plague going on in the world. And so, again, on a metaphysical level, on a thematic level, I just dig everything that's going on in Nosferatu. And so whatever, I don't know, tiny, little gripe, I don't have many gripes with the film, just dug the shit out of it a lot. And what it was trying to say, and how it pulled it off, and just cool thing. Well, I want to see it again, and stuff.
Yeah, I think we're already kind of planning on seeing it sometime this upcoming week.
Oh, yeah, 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 we'll definitely, I think we'll see it again. What have we missed? What have we not talked about so far? I feel like there's got to be some stuff. Nosferatu, you know, cinematography
looks
nice.
If you wanted
nice.
To talk more about Lily's, like, exorcism scene or her, like,
oh, yeah, that's
you
a good
quite
point. That's a good
about.
Point. That's a great scene. That is a really great scene. Because there's these scenes earlier in the film where she's, again, it's kind of an exorcism movie, so she's, you know, where she is spazzing around and everything, and it's difficult to, you know, tell. It's like, well, is she performing that, or is this some sort of special effect or something? It looks performed, but then there's this amazing scene where her conscious mind wants Nicholas Holt and she loves Nicholas Holt, but this weird appetite that she cannot control begins rising up within her, and so he fucks her, and then she has this whole exorcist freak out thing after that. But what I dig about that is, A, it's one of the best scenes in the movie because it feels liberated, you know, and again, spiritually, otherwise, liberated from the kind of Kubrick core of the rest of the movie. The camera moves she's allowed to move around, walk, change her position, and she gives so much physical commitment to this freak out that is all told in, scenes. We can see her whole body perform, move, and she actually begins to deliver her lines.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Bless you. She actually begins to deliver her lines while vibrating wildly and vibrating harshly in that way. And then she, you know, rolls her eyes back and all that. That might be slightly augmented by special effects. But just the intensity of her spasming and shaking and all of that, good on all of them for going that place.
And even speaks I don't know if necessarily she does a new voice, but she changes the tone or way she speaks when she is, like, herself. And then when she is more so feeding into the hunger. Yeah. Like, she does... I especially just remember the moment where she's like pleading for him, gets on her knees, and then just turns up and goes, "You'll never pleasure me," like he does, and then does a different something.
She does freaky voice a few times in the movie. She does freaky exorcist voice, but no, that whole thing was really impressive, and yeah, though definitely don't really question her capability or her commitment as an actress in any way, because man, that she knocks that. Knocked that right out of the park. I'm sure probably Robert Eggers wanted Anya Taylor-Johnson or whatever her name is. What is her name? Anya?
Anya something.
Yeah, Anya Taylor-Johnson. No, sorry. Anya
Taylor-Joy.
Anya Taylor-Joy, Aaron Taylor-Johnson. Wow, no wonder I was having trouble with that. He probably wanted Anya Taylor-Joy, his previous... weird head shape girl, but he needed a new.
I definitely could see her being the wife, the wife that dies character. Yeah.
She's too busy making action movies now to like Furiosa to be his weird head shape girl. So he found a very, 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 very good, strong second weird head shape girl to step in. And man, she pulls off the acting part and the having a weird shaped head part both. Really, really well.
My one silly critique most of the time I saw her was like, somebody tell her wig operator just to pull it forward a little bit. Her wig starts here half the movie.
Yeah, I think that's where I think she just has that shape of a head the whole time.
And so she works it, but it's just.
No, I love it. You know, it all works. Who else? And Willem Dafoe is great, obviously. Oh, we didn't talk about this. Rats. I have not done any looking into this, but that looked like real rats in that fucking scene. They go into a scene that's full of rats, and you know what? Shocking about the rats, they're not CGI. They're CGI later when he sets the room on fire. You see them like dispersing like particles, but you're looking at the fire, so it's just kind of a texture on the bottom of the floor at the time. But it appears, by contrast to every other Hollywood film or film made with any budget in the last few years, it has actual animals on screen being shot with cameras.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see that anymore. You just don't see real rats. It's what made it feel like a real damn movie. Because again, we saw Wicked last night. I actually really liked Wicked. I thought it was a good. I've seen the play or the musical. I thought it was a good adaptation. Well made in a lot of ways. Really dug it. But a majority of the film is what I like about Wicked is a majority of the film is like it's a well-shot musical. They're getting their visual goo out of just people dancing and doing visual gags with taking books and throwing them and spinning them. It's actually very impressive how it's shot. It's not since Spielberg did West Side Story has there been this overshot of a fucking musical because they had all the money in the world and it pays off. But occasionally, like in the beginning of the movie, they will explode into what we talked about loving that is not in Beetlejuice and stuff, which is just a CGI phantasmagoria where they'll do like a shot. There's an opening shot of the film, which is really cool and it's all very real and has to do with a witch hat and textures and a reflection of water and all sorts of stuff. And then there's just like a 10 minutes of CGI monkeys flying over Oz, like under bridges and over shit, and the camera's flying around everywhere. And immediately it takes you completely out of the thing, yada, yada, yada. So we almost take as a foregone conclusion now that if someone is going to go into a room full of rats, that it's just going to be particles. It's just going to be a bunch of particles moving around, You know, you watched that Nutcracker movie for Christmas. They have a mass of rats, and of course, it's all CGI rats.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how arresting and effective it was, and it creeped out the audience, and got lots of little reactions from the audience, just seeing real fucking animals on screen. Holy shit.
And I want to say there's a couple of scenes where you see, like, the rats actually eating people. So there's, like, rats on people.
Oh, yeah, for sure. When you get to the bit with Deadpool Wolverine girl laying on the side of the bed. In that earlier shot, when she starts to get kind of taken by the thing, she has rats on her chest and nibbling on her and shit. Yes, all
That's how she gets the plague, not because of Nosferatu.
Yeah, but all that stuff, you know, made so much better because they are really, really, really there. So I don't know. Everything good. Nosferatu, liked it quite a bit. Probably going to see it again. As we move towards wrapping up, is there anything
I'm really surprised
about?
Unrelated to all that, but I'm really surprised. I feel like most of the time January is a place for movies that are just not good for anywhere else, and I feel like this is such a good movie.
Well, it came out on Christmas Day.
Did it come out? Okay, that makes more sense.
Christmas season is kind of the last legitimate season or releasing season before what is traditionally considered the dumping season, which is the early part of the new year.
Because
you get a bunch of movies building up through the spring and then the summer, and then you get fall movies, which are building towards often the Oscars in December. So you get a lot of awards movies and a lot of things building towards the end of the year. And then you get Christmas movies because it's another time when a lot of people are with their families, a lot of people are off, so there's a window to release movies.
Go see movies and whatnot.
This was released in that window.
Interesting. Well, that makes
sense.
Because
it's Christmas,
then, I guess.
A bunch of people not working.
So it's primo award season kind of a thing, if that is what they are going for.
Yeah, which
then
is also,
I take it back, because this is a very good movie to be dumped in January, but if it wasn't, then I just take it all back.
No, it was not. Definitely not dumped. It definitely got,
it's a huge, huge, prominent release. In fact, they increased the theater count just a couple days ago from like 2,900 screens to, I think, 3,200 something screens.
3,000 more.
300 more.
300 more. Math is not my strong suit.
It's all right, baby. As we've learned from Willem Dafoe, it doesn't need to be. You would be in another age. You would be a priestess of ISIS.
And you know what's not on the ISIS curriculum? Math. Just not there. Not
into
needed.
It.
Yes. Oh, speaking of, I should mention this, and this will transition us then into the scrying portion of the podcast as we draw, pull out our tarot card and stuff, which is in the middle of the thing. I don't know. It was very early on. For reasons I can't quite put my finger on, I just wasn't feeling great. And we had been feeling not great the last couple days because there's a plague going around. And just wasn't feeling particularly good. So I stood up and I walked out of the theater for just a minute and just sort of caught my breath outside of the theater very early on during a couple of the dialogue scenes. I missed a tiny bit.
I think you missed seeing Renfield sitting in the seven-pointed star being
Yes, that is fair.
No, as soon as we see I only saw
the Faustian contract part.
As soon as Jonathan Harker departs, we then see Renfield sitting butt-ass naked in the middle of a seven-pointed star carved into the ground.
Perfect.
I've
sent him to you, my lord. I've sent him to you.
Yeah, yeah. So you kind of miss the main Renfield reveal.
Anyway. No, awesome. But the point is, while Renfield was sitting on his seven-pointed star, I went into the lobby for just a moment, which I never do. I don't like to miss any part of the movie, so it definitely was feeling a bit off.
You were feeling weird.
Yeah, I just needed to kind of collect myself for a second, and then. It was at that moment I received a text message, and the text message was that our sisters had gone out to my parents had just moved to the Shooting Star Ranch, and they our parents have moved out to a ranch near Lampasas called Shooting Star, and so she was texting my parents that there was a meteor shower that night, the night they were moving out to the Shooting Star Ranch, and that at that moment she had seen. The crescent moon conjuncting with Venus, and that a shooting star had passed directly past the crescent moon conjuncting with Venus. Now, for those of you who are unaware, I could probably put up an image of this here. You know, obviously the crescent moon is the kind of a symbol for feminine power and the night world and all of those sorts of things. Literally, the High Priestess card in the tarot, she is wearing a phases of the moon hat that has a crescent moon, a full moon, and a crescent moon coming out of it.
Waxing and waning.
Yeah, and in terms of being a priestess of Isis or Ishtar or Inanna or any of those spirits, Venus being the Roman equivalent of Aphrodite. Being that kind of spirit of feminine creation. And so, in a weird way, Cliff, I do believe that even the stars themselves were aligning around our screening of Nosferatu, which I say only that because if the spirits were whispering, just like to Lily Rose Depp and or to Kevin McAllister, to us while we were watching that movie, then what does it mean for the tarot card that we will draw? So I spoke to the spirits prior to this podcast and asked them for any lessons that we might discern from Nosferatu and was very curious about all of that. But I thought as one fun extra little thing, I put these in here backwards, there we go. Here, take those out of there. As one fun extra little thing, because Willem Dafoe's character in the film is the alchemist who his reputation was ruined because he got into various, I think they talk about Giordano Bruno or Agrippa. A few different people are mentioned as alchemists. I thought we would bring down the three books on occult philosophy. Henry Cornelius Agrippa book. This is annotated by Donald Tyson. There you go. And that we would scry the book itself by opening it up and checking it out. So while you were talking earlier, I just opened the book randomly to a page, and sure enough, it is chapter L3 or L111, and 111 is my lucky number. And it says, of divination and its kinds. So right here as we begin the divination portion, we have this interesting diagram here in the Agrippa, which has, of course, the head of, it is about metoscopy, and has this head subdivided, there it is, I'm holding it in frame now, has this head that is divided into all of the different zodiacal planets. So it is a head, the human mind being divided into the Saturnian energy, Jupiter, other things I can't read, and stuff. So isn't that fun? All of these fun things that we are seeing. So what I'm going to read just the first paragraph and impart this lesson from Cornelius Agrippa into our audience. I have no idea what this is about to say, but we'll see what happens. Cool, everybody? Are you excited?
Sounds good.
Cool. There are some other kinds of divination, depending upon natural causes, which are known to everyone in his art and experience to be in divers things, by which physicians, husbandmen, shepherds, mariners, and every one of these out of probable signs do prognosticate. Many of these kinds Aristotle makes mention of in his Book of Times, amongst which auguria or auspicia are the chiefest, which were in former time such esteem amongst the Romans. Anyway, this is fun stuff about divination, but I strongly suggest everyone read a little bit of alchemy and a little bit of weird magic stuff sometimes, because you might ultimately draw some interesting synchronicities into this world, including seeing Nosferatu immediately after two other Chris Columbus movies, even though for your podcast, even though you had no idea that Chris Columbus was involved in Nosferatu. Anyway, Taylor, do you have our tarot card?
I do. I have not revealed it yet.
What is it? It is the King of Cups. Excellent. Well, that's kind of perfect, in a sense. King of Cups. Perfect, perfect, perfect.
Reverse King of Cups.
Yeah, reverse King of Cups. Let's look at it upright for just a moment. So the King of Cups sits directly on the water, and you can kind of see that here. I think also, by the way, we might want to start drawing the tarot cards at the beginning of the podcast, because I keep feeling like if we drew them at the beginning, I would have so much more to talk about the whole time than just trying to cram it all into a few minutes at the
Fair
end.
Fair enough.
That might not be a bad idea. But his throne is sitting on water, but it's not just sitting directly on water. It's sitting on this little platform among the water. That means he has explored the deepest depths of his emotions and has actually not only found stability in his emotions, but has found stability and emotional responsibility, social responsibility, from the mastery of his emotions. And looking at Nosferatu, I would like to commend the director Robert Eggers, Robert Eggers, because I think this is his King of Cups film. You see that he is a kind of Dionysian animal in all of his other films. You see his kind of Kubrick core influence is the most overt thing, but you see his interest in alchemy and witchcraft is very on Front Street. It's what I like about The Northman the most. It's what I like about The Witch the most. And while as good as The Witch is as a first film, his last two films felt more that they were succumbing, and this is something we talked about a little bit with Megalopolis, succumbing to the point where they didn't know what they were, they didn't know what genre they were instead prioritizing meaning over form to the extent that The Northman would have been my favorite movie if it were also an action movie at the same time, but it lost track of the fact that it was an action movie.
Yeah.
The Lighthouse, I like so many things about it, but I don't even know what that movie is. If it had been about those two guys fighting an actual evil mermaid, you know, and that's what the end of the movie had been about instead of some Bergman knockoff. You know, it's a very cool looking Bergman knockoff, but it's like, that's not what I want, you know, like have them actually fight a fucking mermaid or something. And I feel like Nosferatu, because at the same time it is something he's worked on for 10 years, so he literally had to explore the depths of it, and that's what is explored here with the King of Cups card, again having his throne now rising above these deep, deep waters. He has explored the depths of all of this stuff. He has explored the depths of Nosferatu. He has explored the depths of the cinematic form. He has learned lessons. He has gone on his own fool's journey. And in a way, his emotional maturity, born, say, of all of these previous films, has now turned into a kind of social responsibility. The social responsibility of kingship. The social responsibility of actually making a goddamn horror movie that delivers the goods as a goddamn horror movie. That's the responsibility that we have as filmmakers, is not to, you know, put forward a bunch of tarot cards and then demand, like petulant children, that someone scry meaning from them, but instead to ensnare the mind and trick the mind using genre and plot and all that other stuff so that the meaning seeps in through the side doors. Something done so very, very well in The Witch, but I don't know if it was done so well in The Lighthouse. Something that, let's say, was done really, really well in Get Out, like we talked about, but was not done so well in Us or Nope, which lost track of what they were.
Yeah, yes. Unfortunately.
And now we see, again, a film like Nosferatu, where I think he has woken up to the responsibility of kingship, and that is, if everyone's gonna fucking show up with swords and monsters and shit, you gotta make a movie worthy of swords and monsters and shit, instead of just reflecting on the esoteric meanings of swords and monsters and shit, which is a lesson that Guillermo del Toro could also take to learn. As we eagerly anticipate his Frankenstein movie, which is coming out soon, which will be an interesting companion piece to Robert Eggers' Dracula, in a way. They're being made essentially contemporarily. And in every... And we talked about a little bit on the Creature from the Black Lagoon podcast, I didn't really dig The Shape of Water. I like its meanings. I like certain things it's trying to say. But it, if it were a horror movie, if it knew what it was, then I don't... Then those things would sing. And we talked about it, and even with Godfather 2. Why I'm not one who buys in on the Godfather 2 being superior to Godfather 1 is that everything in Godfather 2 feels incredibly diffuse, because it is it loses track of the fact that it is a gangster movie. If it had taken the same ideas and channeled them through a gangster movie, which is what the first film did, then it would be a superior film. And I feel like The Witch and Nosferatu, the first was the fool movie, stepping out, you know, boldly. This is now a movie of maturity, and it took those other two films to get there. So anyway, I dig this as our ending note for Nosferatu. Anything else that we... Oh, of course, Cliff. Who... we haven't even talked yet about who is the most jacked person in Nosferatu. So now we will end with our Full Metal Jacked Award. To describe, so it, we could, you, if we're the Northman, it would be far easier, but
Northman is fairly straightforward, and but I think this, we don't, I'm just going to give it at this point to the vampire, to Orlok himself.
Huge head.
Huge head. He certainly had no problem grabbing that pickaxe out of the air and tossing it aside. Mm-hmm. So we know there's some muscle tone inside those very strong fingers. I'd say
lifted
despite the rotted flesh,
by the neck very easily, just exactly. Threw those kids
Yes. Exactly. So despite the rotting flesh and despite the rats kind of chewing at the various sinews and connective tissue, he still manages to be a jacked vampire, and for that we applaud him.
Awesome. That works, and plus he looks fucking huge in the movie. Like all the scenes,
very big.
They make him look very, very fucking big. Well, cool. Well, I think that's probably going to be it, you guys. We've been going for a bit. I'm glad we got the chance to talk about Nosferatu here. I'm glad this wraps up our Chris Columbus trilogy this week. So good on Chris Columbus for coming back strong in the 90s now with as a producer and bringing us this fantastic movie. In fact, all the movies really of Robert Eggers, I guess we can thank him for, because he produced The Witch, I guess. Anyway, to that end, until next week, we will continue plugging away at movies, and we will see all of you in... Oh, I'm Kyle.
I was gonna say, like, I'm
we
Taylor.
We didn't introduce ourselves. I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Cliff.
And we will see y'all in a crowded theater.